Well, good morning, church. My name is Hannah Connor, and I am so excited to be with you this morning. Welcome, whether you're here in our live room, you're joining us in the communion venue or online, we hope that you feel right at home here. I have the privilege of being on staff here at FaithBridge, and one of my job responsibilities is to help out with announcements every week. Sometimes I'll do that here on stage, sometimes it's through a video. And even though I've been doing it for about a year and a half, there is one thing that makes me really nervous every single time. See, I worked at Starbucks for about 6 years. So every time that I say good morning, welcome to FaithBridge, the words that almost come out of my mouth are good morning, welcome to Starbucks. And I haven't said it yet, but I've come pretty close a couple of times. You know, Starbucks was really the perfect job for me while I was finishing school. I have a degree in creative writing. I got to meet so many wonderful and quirky people who were easy to put in short stories. I love stories. And something that I've noticed recently is the popularity of a certain kind of story. That is the villain origin story. That's a story that traces an individual's descent and transformation into some figure of evil. Now think about the first few Star Wars movies where we meet young Anakin Skywalker and he grows up to become, spoiler alert, Darth Vader, right? Or more recently, movies like Cruella and Wicked. I know a couple of people even found the character of Thanos from the Avengers movies to be pretty sympathetic. My daughter was about 7 when she saw the last of the real Avengers movies, and I remember her saying, well, he was actually being pretty nice to the half of the people he left alive. So pray for us about that situation. You won't believe what she said when she was 8 and she saw Breaking Bad for the first time. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. But there's another great example. Walter White, mild-mannered high school chemistry teacher who slowly transforms into a ruthless drug kingpin over the course of 5 seasons. And why are we so drawn to these stories of degradation and failure, I wonder? Well, I think in part because they tell us an uncomfortable truth about ourselves. They show us the shadow side of our nature and what we could become if only circumstances conspired against us. And we're fascinated by that transformation. You may remember at the beginning of the year, we had a tragic real-life example of this when the world saw Luigi Mangione kill the CEO of United Healthcare in cold blood. And if you read anything about that young man, you might recall that he was from a wealthy family. He went to prestigious private schools. But when he was younger, he suffered a back injury that led to chronic pain, that led to disillusionment with the American healthcare system. Step by small step, he began a journey that would end with him on trial for murder. And the question that we all have to ask ourselves when we see these stories unfold is, could that happen to me? What would have to go wrong in my life for me to be capable of something like that? Could I turn from the person that I am today into somebody unrecognizable? And because of human nature, the answer to that question is yes. How does it happen, though? Little by little. The story that we are in today could be listed along with the great villain origin stories that we mentioned earlier. Now, the Bible gives us plenty of instances of people who failed spectacularly, but few of them have the devastating character arc of King Saul. Saul was the first king of Israel. You see, after a season of being led by a series of judges, Israel was tired of being different than all of their neighbors, and they said to God, "We want a king." And God said, "You have a king. I'm your king." And they said, no, we want a king with skin on. And so God chose for them King Saul. And by all external measures, he was a winner. He was tall. He was handsome. He was an easy swipe right. But by the time he dies, he's been disgraced. He's been stripped of the kingship by God. He's turned into a vengeful tyrant and a would-be murderer. And no one could have known that Saul was headed for such a colossal crash and burn, could they? Saul comes onto the scene in 1 Samuel chapter 9. And then in chapter 10, he's anointed king. He has some key military victories, and he starts gaining renown and popularity with his people, with the Israelites. But then, by chapter 15, he's acting in outright rebellion against God. And by chapter 16, God is already looking for a new king. Saul starts strong, but goes downhill so quickly. I want us to go a little bit further upstream today, though. You see, I think that there were signs all along the way and that Saul was oblivious to them. I think there were indicators that all was not right in Saul's heart and in his mind long before God found a young shepherd to replace him as king. I want us to look at what happened in Saul's life before the outright disobedience so that that can serve as a warning to us. How can we know if we, like Saul, are headed for disaster and disgrace? Well, there are three lessons that I think we can learn to avoid Saul's mistakes. We're going to start reading in chapter 13, and if you need a Bible, the ushers are going to be coming down the aisles with some in just a moment. You can wave your hand and they'll be happy to give you one. If you don't own a Bible, please feel free to keep this. It's our gift to you. In chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, we see that Saul has just celebrated some great military victories, but now things have taken a turn for the worse. He's holed up in an area called Gilgal, and he's been told to wait for God's prophet and priest, Samuel. Now, last week, Jared Darby introduced us to Samuel as a young man who was learning to hear the voice of God. And Samuel has now grown up to become a prominent figure in Israel. And Saul needs Samuel to arrive because Samuel has a key part to play before Saul's men can engage the Philistines. We're going to pick up reading in verse 8. He, Saul, waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him, and Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you didn't come within the days appointed and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, well, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I've not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue." The first lesson that we can learn from Saul is this: look up, not around. Now, I used to attend a Bible study for young singles back when I was a young single and not an old married. And I didn't know a soul there, but I still went every single week to this Bible study down in the city. And one week in particular, nothing really different was happening except that I kept feeling my attention being drawn to this guy that was sitting in the same row that I was in, just a couple of seats down. And I knew, without a doubt, that God wanted me to go and talk to this young man. Specifically, he wanted me to go and tell him that I was glad he was here. Now, I was the kind of kid that refused to order their own food at a restaurant until I was about 14 years old, so this was a really big ask, and one that I had no intention of doing. So for the entire service, I just spent the time telling God why he was wrong and why I was not the right person to do this. First of all, I said, I can't just go and introduce myself to this guy. He's going to think that I'm hitting on him. That's going to be embarrassing. Absolutely not. People at the study were not very friendly. Everybody came in with their little cliques and their little groups. They sat together and they ignored everyone else. Not even the leaders went around talking to people. Second of all, I said, I'm not going to start welcoming people to this event that I have nothing to do with. Absolutely not. But I could tell that God was not changing his mind. So the service ended, and I knew what I had to do, but I didn't do it. I didn't budge. And that guy got up and left without me speaking a word to him. And I knew, without a doubt, that I had just disobeyed God. I was just so worried about what someone was going to think. Preoccupation with what the people around you are doing will never lead to obedience. This is the very first excuse that Saul gives Samuel when he's confronted. I saw that the people were scattering from me. And in many ways, Saul's reaction is understandable. He was losing his army. How is a king supposed to fight without an army? He was very aware of what it potentially meant for him to be deserted by his men. No doubt the scenario is playing over and over in his mind. The humiliation of surrender, the inevitable death at the hands of his enemies. No, he needed to act quickly, or he knew that he would lose the remainder of his men. And the author of Hebrews is so familiar with our tendency to focus on what's happening all around us that he says this: Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. In order to run the race marked out for us, we've got to fix our eyes only on Jesus. Looking to the left or to the right will result in distraction and in failure. Now, Saul's hyper-awareness of what's going on around him, that's not what lost him the kingship eventually, but it is one of the things that put him in danger. It was one small thing that, when coupled with another and another and another, turned him into the kind of person who refused to listen to God's commands. It was one more step on the path to disobedience. And if we're going to learn from Saul's mistake, then we need to look up and not around. The second lesson that we can learn from Saul is to practice patience. In verse 8, we're told that Samuel is really clear about when he is going to arrive, in 7 days' time. But Saul barely waited. He was impatient. And impatience did to Saul what it does to all of us. It made him take matters into his own hands. In this case, he made the sacrifices that only the priest was supposed to make. He needed these sacrifices to happen before he could make any kind of a move on the Philistines. He needed Samuel specifically to make the burnt offering and the peace offerings. Now, in the burnt offering, it was a sacrifice that symbolized complete dedication and devotion to God. While the peace offering, part of the animal was burned, part was eaten by the person making the sacrifice, part was eaten by the priests, and that symbolized fellowship and renewed and restored relationship. These were key rituals that took place before any battle, and they were a public testament that victory is up to God, and it's not determined by the strength of armies. Samuel was allowed to make these sacrifices because he was a priest. Saul wasn't, but he did it anyway. And more than any other moment, this act shows us just how far Saul's heart is from God. This is Saul's attempt to force God's hand. Saul is choosing to put his trust in a ritual and not in his relationship with God. He's not relating to God as his creator and sustainer, as Israel's rescuer and redeemer. He's treating God like a war machine that he can point at his enemies, push this button, pull this lever, make this sacrifice, and get the result that he wants. And how many times have you and I actually done something similar? When waiting on God becomes too hard, we can scoot over to that driver's seat pretty quickly, can't we? Doesn't it just feel like God shows up late sometimes? 6 years ago, my family and I were living in the UK as missionaries when my husband began to experience health issues. He began to fall sick for weeks at a time, weeks laid up in bed. We didn't know why. But after living like this for several months, we realized that this was going to cut our time in the mission field short. We realized we needed to come back to the States. And we hoped that living near friends and family would make the burden of a mysterious chronic condition easier to bear. But when we got back here, Jason's health did not improve. In fact, for about 3 years, it got worse and worse. And we went to specialist after specialist. They ran every test they had, always returning a clean bill of health. Meanwhile, he was unable to work consistently and often bedridden. And we prayed for his healing for years. And today, I'm happy to say that he's living a much more normal life. He's sick much less often, but we never received an answer. And while we were praying so desperately, and those bills were piling up, God has brought us out of that season, and we are so grateful. But does it feel like he showed up on time? Not really. It's hard to have faith when the stakes are high and it feels like God is nowhere to be found. When you're looking for a job and that savings account is getting smaller and smaller. When you're longing to be in a relationship, to be married or to have a child. Or when you're praying for someone that you love to come to know the Lord, when you're praying for healing. If we want to avoid Saul's slow transformation
into hard-heartedness, then we've got to practice patience, because there will come a time when we have to wait on the Lord long past what we are comfortable with. And the temptation will be to do what Saul did, to take matters into our own hands. And if we do that, we'll be taking one more step on the path to rejecting God's ways completely. Now, what it looked like for me to take matters into my own hands was this. While my husband was sick, I decided that the welfare of my family was actually up to me. The trust that I had placed in him to take care of us, to look out for us, to provide for us, I took that trust back. And I decided that if anything good was going to come our way, it would come because I went out and got it. What it can often look like to take matters into our own hands is to find coping mechanisms to deal with the pain in our lives instead of taking that pain and uncertainty to God. We can self-medicate with control, with alcohol, with pornography, with mindless scrolling, instead of allowing God to meet our needs in his time. Saul's story teaches us that we must, one, look up, not around; two, that we need to practice patience; and three, that we need to tell the right story. The last reason that Saul gives Samuel when explaining why he didn't wait is that the Philistines were gathering, getting ready for warfare. Saul was looking at the forces numbered against him, and understandably, he was nervous. But he wasn't telling himself the whole story. He wasn't remembering the times that God had shown up for him in battle before. And when we only tell ourselves about the odds stacked against us, that's not the whole truth. Telling ourselves the right story means we remember the ways God has proved himself faithful over and over. You see, what we meditate on while we are waiting has the power to make or break us. And this is one of the reasons that at this church, we show video testimonies of faith bridgers from time to time. Hearing stories of God's trustworthiness increases our faith, even if it's somebody else's story. It's also one of my favorite things that I get to do at my job here. Now, I'm on the communications team, and we work behind the scenes. We are not just seeing the sausage be made. We are back there stuffing the casings every week. So we don't always get to see the stories of life transformation and redemption that take place in this congregation, except for when we do a video interview. Because then I get to sit down across from an individual or a couple, and I get to ask them, what was it like the years that you were waiting? How did you stay faithful in that time? And finally, how did you see God show up? And I am never more energized than when we wrap up a video interview, and I feel like I have just gotten a front row seat to witness God's faithfulness to his people. This is one of the most important things that we can do for each other as believers, and it's one of the reasons that we desperately need each other. When life is difficult, we can remind one another that God can be trusted. We can do this for our spouses, for our friends, for our children, and even for ourselves. You can remember the times that God has been good to us before. Each time that we navigate a hardship and we come out on the other side, maybe battered and bruised, but still clinging tightly to Jesus, we've just won another proof of his faithfulness. And in that way, moments of our greatest uncertainty can actually be moments of future testimony. Now, that day when I disobeyed God at the Bible study, I knew so clearly what he wanted me to do. I was just so unwilling to do it. And part of the reason that I was reluctant is that I didn't have a long history of moments like this with God to look back on. And so I stubbornly refused, and I let the moment pass. And as I got up to leave that night, I remember feeling heavy with disappointment in myself. But as I was walking my car, I saw coming down the hallway towards me the guy that I knew I was supposed to go talk to. And I knew that if I did not act immediately, I would just chicken out again. So I practically ran up to him, and I put out my hand to shake his, and I said, "Hey, I was sitting near you in the service today, and I didn't get a chance to say hi before. But I just wanted to tell you that I'm really glad you were here tonight." And he reached out to shake my hand, and with no preamble and with so much misery in his voice, he asked me, "Why do you believe in God?" And I remember feeling really stunned and like I did not know what to say. But I sat and I talked with him. And I am positive that I said nothing eloquent, maybe not even anything educated, but I listened and I prayed for him. And here's the thing, I don't know if that was meaningful for him at all. Never saw him again. But I know how meaningful that moment was for me. Because that was the night that God and I started to build something together. And the next time that I heard him telling me to do something that I did not want to do, what did I think of? I thought of that night. Telling myself that story has helped me to be faithful, and it's helped me to be obedient over and over so many times. And here's something else I remember about our conversation that night. Once we started talking, I realized that this young man wasn't struggling as much with whether or not God existed as with whether or not God loved him. And maybe you're here today and you've been wondering the same thing. Maybe you've done some things that make it hard for you to believe that God could love you. In each of us, there is such a deep longing to be known and to be loved. When the Israelites longed for a king to lead them, the very best that the world could offer was King Saul, someone with deep flaws on a downward trajectory. But God sent us another king with skin on, a king that had no shortcomings, no tendencies to be fearful or impatient. And it's because of this man, Jesus, that we can be certain of God's love for us. God loved us enough to send his son to live a life that you and I could never live, to die the death that we all deserved, conquering sin on the cross. You see, when it was Jesus' turn to decide if he would be obedient, he submitted, even though it meant death on the cross. Where Saul failed, Jesus didn't. And when we know how great God's love is for us, it changes everything. It allows us to live a life of purpose and fulfillment and meaning. And telling ourselves the right story means that when we are tempted to take matters into our own hands, or when we are full of questions, when we're full of doubt, it's one of the most powerful tactics that we have to stay grounded in reality, to stay grounded in what's true, and to stay connected to God's great love for us. Let's recap what Saul has taught us so far. One, look up, not around. Two, practice patience. And three, tell the right story. When we do these three things, we are guarding against those small steps that can take us from following God to walking away from him. Now, Saul didn't do these things, and little by little, his heart hardened to God, and he found himself in rebellion against God. You know, when I read this passage, I think it would be nice if we could look at this story and say, everything would have worked out if Saul had just listened and done what he was told. It's tempting to think that, but it would be a huge mistake. We can't be sure what would have happened. We often assume that if we are obedient, then good things are going to come our way. But God calls us to obey even though it might be costly, even though things might not work out the way that we want. It's possible that Samuel would have come and made the sacrifices and the Israelites would have won the day against their enemies. That might have happened. But it also might have happened that Saul did everything right and he could have still lost the battle. He could have lost his life even. And that doesn't mean that his obedience would have been in vain or that God would have failed him. You see, Saul did not understand what he was called to. The Christian life is never a call to win, and it is always a call to die. And the place where Saul was unwilling to go is the place where God is leading each and every one of us, to the place that we either have to abandon our own ambitions or we've got to part ways with Jesus. Jesus is going to win in the very end. We can be so confident of that, but we can't make the mistake of assuming that he is always gonna come through for us exactly like we want or exactly like we expect. He might not. And he invites us to follow him anyway. And I know that some of you listening today, you recognize yourself in Saul's story because you have been making the wrong choices. Maybe you're in a situation that you never imagined you could be in, morally compromised. Maybe it's a relationship outside your marriage. Maybe it's something dishonest in your finances or at work. But you know that you've messed up, and you can even look back and see the small steps that led you to where you are today. If that is you, then hear this. God's calling you to radical obedience. He's asking you to turn from hidden sin and surrender fully to him now, today. This is your wake-up call. Your mistakes don't have to lead you to reject God. There is a path back to him. And it won't be easy. It may cost you something, but it will lead to freedom. Let me suggest a next step for you. We're gonna have prayer partners up here as the worship team leads us in this last song. Come and let somebody pray for you today. Let them pray that you would have the strength to obey, that you'd have the courage to follow where God is leading you. I hope that you won't leave without talking to somebody about what you're facing. Don't listen to the voice that might be telling you you can handle it on your own. If that were the case, you probably wouldn't be in quite the mess that you're in, right? Maybe you need prayer for something else entirely. Maybe it's not an issue of hidden sin. Maybe you're just up against something insurmountable. Maybe you need prayer for healing or for a situation that you're walking through with your family. We would love to pray with and for you today. In fact, let's go to God together now. Lord, we come here today carrying so many things. Our own mistakes, hurts from the sins of others. And you see all that's in our hearts. You know what we need. And you know how we've tried to manage without you. You know the ways that we've resisted you. We admit that what we are facing is too big for us and that we need you. It's as simple as that. Won't you be near, Lord? Won't you meet us today, God?